Okay, it's your turn now. We're going to open up the phone lines from all around the planet to let you talk with Joseph Farrell, fellow Earthlings. So we'll do that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, you and Richard have alluded to the elites on this planet of wanting us to know some certain things, to release information to us. Why would they do that? Why do they want us to know these things?
Well, the only thing that I can think of, George, is personally, I think these elites, for the most part, act out of their own self-interest. So in any release that they are planning or that they have done, they're doing so, in my opinion, out of their self-interest. And in this case, I think their self-interest is to get enough people behind them to maintain their power base. I think really that's what's going on. Although I do entertain the possibility, I must admit, that we may be looking and probably are looking at a great deal of factional infighting. So you may have some people that are releasing this information out of pure altruistic reasons. So it could be one, it could be the other.
Well, it could be two. There's no question, and I would agree with you, that they have their own method and
right.
They have their own means, and they do. I think some of the things they see, for example, in the Middle East, where they see people just uprising, upset, drives them crazy.
Oh, I do, too. I do, too. I wholeheartedly agree with you there. I think that there's an element of spontaneity to this that is beyond whatever control that they may have exercised to bring some of it about. I think there's an element here that is out of their hands, out of their control, and that is, like you say, driving them crazy.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Charleston, West Virginia. Our first-time caller is Ed. He's on Coast to Coast. Hey, Ed, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. It's good to get through, finally.
Sure.
The question I had was President Obama invited to the royal wedding? I was under the impression he didn't get an invitation.
Now, that's an interesting question. I don't know.
It is an interesting take, and I myself don't know the answer, but if he was not invited, then it, to my mind, Ed, would add a little bit more credence to what Richard was arguing, namely that he chose a deliberately symbolic setting into which to communicate a message that basically was thumbing the nose at the City of London crowd, much like Hitler, again, in the example I cited, chose the very railroad car in the very spot to accept the French surrender that the French had made the Germans surrender to them in World War I. So I think messages were being sent.
Well, let's say, and here's a story that is from a paper in the United Kingdom that says President Obama and his wife Michelle will not be invited to Prince William's wedding next year. So this is an old story from December of 2010, because Prince William is not yet heir to the throne and his wedding to Kate Middleton is not classed as a state occasion, and the couple feel under no pressure to fill the 2,000-strong guest list with heads of state. So there you go.
Yeah, to my mind, George, it's a convenient explanation. I do think that there are things going on here that are diplomatic messages. But yeah, it's a convenient explanation for them.
All right, let's go to Shirley in Birch Bay, Washington. There she is, west of the Rockies. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, George. How are you this evening?
Okay, thank you.
I have a thing I read in a book that Obama's grandfather, when he in Kenya, when England still, was over that part of the country, that his grandfather fought against England, and he worked for the Standard Oil Company, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there might be a connection there too, because his grandfather hated the colonization.
Well, I have to agree to a certain extent, Shirley, because we also have to remember that President Obama is black, and the English were certainly involved heavily with the slave trade. So he has yet another motivation in his background not to attend a wedding like that. So yeah, but again, I'm more on board with the symbolism that Richard has mentioned in terms of the address that he gave to the nation. I think that, again, that was a clear signal, a clear message being sent. And they, leaders have done that sort of thing all throughout history. communicating symbolic messages in the way that they stage diplomatic events.
Have you heard anything about underground bunkers that the elitists have built all over this planet?
Have I? Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the most intriguing ones to me, George, there's a fellow I know that you've had on your show by the name of Richard Sauder that has investigated this whole subject.
Yes.
And I think he's still doing so, the last I heard. But one of the interesting things, I think it was Richard's work that clued me in that there is something big going on in terms of elites building their bunkers, was the fact that the Walton family, you know, behind Walmart, has built a fairly large complex of underground facilities like that. So something is up, definitely.
Indeed. Let's go to William, Houston, Texas. There you go. Hey, William, thank you. Still dry out there?
Thank you. Actually, I'm in Jersey. I'm just from Texas right now.
Oh, okay. All right, great.
I want to touch on gold and precious metals real quick, but first I want to ask your guest, all of the different statues and paintings and drawings that we see in Egypt and other parts of the world that show the half human and half animals. What is his take on that? Are these literal things that he saw?
Oh, wow. Excellent question. My opinion is, if you look at those Egyptian hieroglyphs where you have chimerical creatures depicted, and again, I put some of these pictures in Genies, Giants, Monsters, Men, because you can find similar types of depictions in Mesopotamian art and Babylonian art of chimerical creatures, blending of humans and animals. What's really interesting to me, Ed, is if you admit the possibility that an ancient technology of genetic engineering existed, what these pictures may represent is not actual things that looked exactly like what you're seeing, but rather kind of figurative depictions of blending of DNA elements from one thing to another. So in other words, you're not looking at actual birdmen, but you're looking at perhaps a kind of a figurative way of saying that somebody was tinkering around with bird DNA and human DNA and producing kind of a chimerical result from them. So yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because again, I think these little artworks may be further clues of one sort or another into the possibility of a very sophisticated technology in play.
Very sophisticated. Skype
very,
caller,
very.
Logan in Tallahassee, Florida. Hey, Logan, go ahead.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Okay.
Pretty good.
All right. So here's the thing. Did you get any research about how the cosmic war actually ended up, or is it still ongoing?
Well, another excellent question. In fact, that's a great question. In my book, The Cosmic War, I point out that the war actually ended, and the reason it ended is they basically blew each other.
Yeah, it was annihilation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was annihilation. Yeah, you know, mutually assured destruction. But I also had to conclude, based on research that I was encountering when I wrote that book, which is why I've been writing these other books since then, you know, beginning with Philosopher's Stone and Babylon's Banksters and Genies, Giants, Monsters, and Men, is I had to conclude that somebody survived that war. You had a group of people that were an elite that decided, number one, they had to preserve the knowledge that had made their civilization possible, number one. And then number two, they had to jumpstart civilization back into existence. And one of the first activities, and I cover in this in a whole chapter in Genies, Giants, Monsters, and Men, one of their first activities was to create units of measure that could be reproducible anywhere in the world to allow a system of common weights and measures in order to conduct trade. You've got to have a system of weights and measures in order to conduct commerce. And if you're going to have a system of accurate weights and measures to do that, then the only way to base measures on is not what the archaeologists tell you, that they're basing it on body parts, which of course are going to vary from person to person. You're going to have to base it on astronomical data, and you're going to have to base it right off the planet Earth off of geodetic data. And that's what I explore. So that's an excellent question.
Okay, thank you for that. Next up, our wild card line, we've got Rick in Cochran, Georgia. Go ahead, Rick.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to ask Dr. Farrell if he's familiar with Lloyd Pye's work and the idea that our the history of the human race is inherent in our genealogical our genes and our chromosomes, and that you know, that there's so much what they call junk genes, and I think that the history of the human race is inherent in there, and we just have to glean it out.
Well, that's an excellent question, Rick. In fact, I have a whole chapter in, again, in Gene Steinem's Monsters and Men, where I talk about the genetic code as being a history, as being a monument in itself that tells the story of human history. And I base that particular chapter off of the work of an Oxford geneticist by the name of Brian Sykes, who's been doing a lot of genotyping of various branches of the human family and trying to figure out how they all fit together and piece together a historical picture. So you're absolutely right. That's what DNA is. It's a hidden book of human history. Now, you mentioned Lloyd Pye and junk DNA, and that's another good question. I'm not familiar with his works. I'm certainly familiar with his name. But there is a school of thought out there in the alternative research field that suggests that junk DNA is perhaps the biggest part of this hidden history. There are those that are suggesting that this stuff is the missing extraterrestrial component of human DNA. I have not seen enough evidence to suggest that. And in fact, there are Russian geneticists that are suggesting that that so-called junk DNA is something very, very different. It's a specialized kind of programming language within the DNA helix itself. So the evidence isn't in on that one, but the problem here, Rick, is that if that junk DNA was somehow a clear marker of some genetic component that came from off this planet, I doubt very much that we would ever be told or allowed to see enough of the evidence to back that up. So that's the problem with that.
You know, there still seems to be, and as you have written in many of your books, Joseph, a Nazi influence on many things still on this country.
Yes.
It seems to be everywhere, isn't it?
Well, it is, George, and, you know, the whole subject of eugenics that arose in the 1920s and 1930s in this country, in England, and certainly in Germany, that's an aspect of the story that I knew existed. I did not get into it in Genes, Giants, Monsters, Men simply for the reason that to do so would have complicated the whole matter a whole lot more. I think there is a component, a hidden component of the genome project. There's a hidden agenda to it. Although, having said that, I have to qualify that by saying it's an intuition. I do, Scott and I, in The Grid of the Gods, we do talk about a Nazi connection and interest in the world grid system. So there's there's another part of the Nazi story entering into this.
Yeah, there sure is. Let's go to Fillmore, California. Hello, Alan. It's your turn. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
Good.
And Mr. Farrell, nice to talk to you.
Nice to meet you, Alan.
Yes. And, George, first of all, I have to say something to you, because yesterday I heard you on the radio saying about Dr. Zahi Hawass, yes, from Egypt, the antiquity person, right?
Right, right.
Yes, and you have even noticed that every time somebody asks him how the pyramids were built, he doesn't know.
He doesn't want to tell you.
No, he doesn't. Huh. He acts like he doesn't know where they just cut the stone, they put it in place, and that's it.
And then he gets mad when you come up with a different theory.
Yes, I mean, you know, that is absolutely incredible. And, you know, but I wanted to ask Mr. Farrell one question.
Uh-huh. Sure.
If the ancients, you know, this theory about the ancients, and they were so advanced with this technology, mm-hmm. then isn't it that then we must be going backwards, right?
Well, in a certain sense, I think I understand what you're meaning. In a certain sense, I think that's true, because one of the things I discuss in the book that's coming out next month, Grid of the Gods, is that, and George and I talked about it earlier tonight, and that's the idea that we are returning, really, in the state of our science now, to a pitch of development that seems to be indicated by these ancient texts. In other words, a lot of the things that we're claiming are discoveries, we're really sort of rediscovering. That's what's really going on.
Okay, there you go. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Let's go to Scott in Grand Chute, Wisconsin. Scott, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, George, thank you for accepting my call and greetings to you. My question has to do with several months ago, you reported that a larger pyramid than the Great Pyramid in Egypt was discovered in Eastern Europe. I forget if it was Ukraine or Belarus.
You still there?
I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You dropped. Go ahead.
I'm wondering if this new discovery of a bigger pyramid that has obviously astronomical implications has to do with part of this genotype seeding that you're talking about.
Well, that's a very interesting question, Scott. I'll kind of pry the lid off of The Grid of the Gods, the book that's coming out. I do not, in that book, talk about the Bosnian pyramid for one very important reason, and that is there's not, to my mind, enough data about its dimensions, about its composition, and so on, available yet for me to draw any conclusions about that particular site. But I will say this. In examining the sites that Scott and I examined in that book, we came to the conclusion, very, very similar to what Mr. Hoagland did on television last year, that these were deliberately designed structures of some sort of higher dimensional physics or hyperdimensional physics. And there are certain very technical reasons that I advance in that book as to why that's the case. Now, you mentioned a genetic component in connection with it. I have not argued anywhere a case that there is some sort of genetic component to this technology. I have hinted at that in Babylon's Banksters. I hint at it again very deliberately in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And I first raised the subject of a genetic component to all of this technology in the Cosmic War. So, yeah, my intuition is exactly the same as yours, that we're looking at a science that was so sophisticated that there was some sort of interplay or some sort of interface between genetic and biological science and the physical sciences. So I think your intuition is very sound.
Joseph, if the elitists hear a program like this, they hear you talking, what do they do? Do they go crazy the next morning? Do they call each other? What do they do?
Well, that's another good question, George. You know, I've often sat here wondering and pondering that same thing. I think to a certain extent they have to do nothing, because most of what researchers like myself are doing in this field is already public knowledge. We're just connecting dots in a certain interesting way. So there's nothing really they can do to prevent the human mind from connecting dots. You know, you can't get rid of one person because someone else is going to connect the same dots in the same way. So, you know, I think right now they just sort of have to live with it.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, Joseph, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take final phone calls with you. Joseph Farrell, his book, of course, we've been talking about all night long, Genes, Giants, Monsters and Men. His website, of course, is linked up right there for you at coasttocoastam.com. And of course, if you need to email me, that's very simple. That's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. We'll come back in just a moment. I'll tell you what's in store on our next Coast to Coast program, and we'll take final phone calls with Joseph Farrell right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, John DeSalvo joins us. We're going to talk about the Shroud of Turin as we get close to Easter. It's coming up right around the corner. And by the way, 25 sponsorships to go for Children International, and we have reached our second goal. Then we'll do our third one and get this wrapped up. 25 sponsorships. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. You'll see the picture there of me and the little child. Just click that on the homepage. You can also call this 1-800 number. 1-800-301-9194. Sponsor a child for $22 a month for about a one-year commitment, and that is it. That's what they're asking you to do, and that's what I'm asking you to do. When we come back, let's take final phone calls with Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, these monsters that you talk about in the book, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, were they genetic mistakes?
Well, I think another good question. I think there are a mix of things. One of the things I mentioned in the book, kind of following the line of Adrian Mayer, is that some of these monsters were how the ancient peoples rationalized dinosaur fossils that they found. So in that sense, no. But I think the other thing that you have to remember is if we're dealing with a genetic technology, yes, then some of these things could very easily, very, very easily have been genetic mistakes. Absolutely. In fact, let me add to that, because if you read what Scott and I cite in The Grid of the Gods, we spent a lot of time with the Mayan texts, and the Mayan texts make it very clear that there were mistakes made in some of this engineering. So, yeah.
Okay, now we go back to the calls. We'll go to Carlisle, Illinois. Kent's with us on Coast to Coast up there. Hi, Kent.
Hey, thanks a lot, George. Listen to you on KTRS in St. Louis. Joseph, I'm definitely going to buy your book. I have a couple of questions, one about torsion fields and one about terraforming Mars and replanting everything here on Earth. But the first one's about torsion fields. Have you ever heard about what I refer to as weight manipulating gyros? A gyro, in effect, does manipulate weight, but what I'm saying is gyros that manipulate weight in a way that is upward.
Yes, yes, I have heard of that. And in fact, it's very interesting that you mention that, because I cover a Soviet astrophysicist in my book, The Philosopher's Stone, by the name of Dr. Nikolai Kozarev, and he did a lot of classified work in the Soviet Union. We didn't even know this was going on until after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But he did a lot of work that I describe in The Philosopher's Stone using gyros and noticing exactly the same thing that you're saying. But the key with his work, and this is very, very crucial, the key with his work is that he would notice variations of weight loss depending upon the time that he performed the experiment, meaning if he performed it during summer or winter, and also the place on the face of the Earth or on the face of the globe where he performed the experiment. So this is the other key thing about torsion, is that you have to remember that it's an ever-changing dynamic system. So that explains why you get these slight variations in experimental results. But it's an excellent question.
Another thing about dinosaurs, I always had the theory, and I don't know why, that it was possible that the ancient extraterrestrials, because life was suspected on Mars in the past, that they actually used Mars as a prep to set up Earth eventually, and that both were terraformed, and Mars was simply turned off. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know if you could say that Mars was turned off. The researcher Graham Hancock, and I cite him in one of my very early books called The Giza Death Star Deployed, and specifically in reference to Mars. Mr. Hancock has a very, very interesting book out called The Mars Mystery, and he describes the geology of the planet and its very, very peculiar characteristics. And in his terms, and I have to wholeheartedly agree with him, in his terms, Mars, he says, is a murdered planet. In other words, the destruction and devastation on Mars was so sudden and so quick and so planet-wide that the only way to describe it is as a murdered planet.
Violent.
Violent, yes, violent. Quite violent.
All right, next up we go to Mike Emmett, Idaho. You're on Coast to Coast. Mike, go ahead.
All right, I'd like to thank you guys for taking my call. My question was... if you look into Norse mythology, there's it's called the region of darkness and cold. It's called if I'm pronouncing it right, it's called Niflheim. It bears a real striking resemblance to the biblical word Nephilim.
Yes.
If you transposition the letters, it just looks very similar. I was just wondering if you know, kind of. The word, the culture's rubbed off. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yes. Is there, in other words, you're asking, is there a connection between the biblical story and the Norse mythology?
Yeah, for example, because I've heard that possibly biblical giants migrated up into Europe. And I was just wondering if that word could have had come up with them. You know what I'm
saying? Oh, boy. Mike, that's such a great question. And, in fact, it's so complicated, I haven't even wrote a book about it yet. I want to eventually, because there have been people that have investigated this whole problem of the migrations in terms of ancient texts and legends and so on. The reason I haven't written about it is that to do that kind of detailed study would be an enormous, enormous task. You'd have to know a great deal of different languages, and you'd have to know a great deal about the actual texts themselves and what they're saying. I know that there are people that have done these studies, but they're very, very obscure. I'm investigating some of them right now, and I'm kind of prepping, I hope, for what will be a book about that subject down the line. It's an excellent question.
Give us a little highlight again of the new one coming out in May.
The new one coming out is the first official collaboration with a co-author, George, that I've done. A friend of mine, about for half of my life, actually, a fellow PhD from Oxford by the name of Scott DeHart. And like myself, with a background in theology, we're doing a book that's coming out in May called The Grid of the Gods. And the subtitle of that book, which will explain, more or less explain it all, is The Aftermath of the Cosmic War and the Physics of the Pyramid Peoples. So in other words, we're looking specifically at pyramidal ancient sites and the technologies and physics behind them.
This war that annihilated both sides, it had to have been nuclear, right?
Well, actually, that's another good question. In the cosmic war, George, I actually do not think it was nuclear. I think it was something far worse.
Really?
Yeah. If you can imagine something worse than nuclear weapons. Huh. Basically, I think the weapons were torsion based or if you will, scalar based weapons. We're talking again, George, about weapons that would make a hydrogen bomb look more or less like a kitchen match. So, it's quite a scale above anything that we have today.
All right, we'll go now to Long Beach, California. Joe's turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Joe. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I was wondering if you have any information on whether people, like elite people that are in like the Bilderberg group, such as like the Queen of England, if they're actually, are these people actually Nazis, some of them, or cult members? And if so, like, how are we to know for sure?
Oh, boy, another great question. As a matter of fact, I talk about the Bilderbergers, the Nazis, and the elites that were involved in the early Bilderberg days in my book, Babylon's Banksters. Essentially, it's very, very difficult, Joe, to get accurate and exact information about the memberships of these elite people in various secret societies or occult groups. It's very, very difficult. There's a lot of information out there, but the problem is the information has to be substantiated. So at best, we're left with a case that you have to read their actions, you have to read the symbols by which they accompany their actions, much like Mr. Hoagland was saying earlier with President Obama's speech, with those three very, very distinct presidents framed in the speech. But beyond that, it's very difficult to get information. That being said, in Babylon's Banksters, I do make the case that the real functional purpose of the early Bilderberg meetings was precisely to coordinate the financial activities of the post-war Nazi elite, which, you know, we have to understand the Nazis just didn't cease existing. They survived the war, and they survived the war in an organized and well-financed fashion, to coordinate activities between them and the Anglo-American corporate elite on the other that had the banks for the Nazi loot. So, yeah, it's a big story.
Is there anything going on in Antarctica, Joe?
There is, George. In my book, Roswell and the Reich, I ended that book with some charts of seismic activity that when I saw them, George, they just blew my mind of seismic activity in Antarctica, because you had these very, very long wave, low frequency waves just all over the chart on these seismograms. And it's anybody's guess as to what's going down there. But these seismograms just do not look like any normal sort of earthquake. there's just no way they can be.
Something's going on.
Yeah, absolutely, something's going on.
Off to Lexington, Kentucky, and it's Jerry's turn. Hey, Jerry, go ahead.
Good morning, fellas.
Morning.
Dr. Farrell. Incidentally, I've got a cousin named Joseph Farrell.
Oh, cool. But,
yeah. I have a theory that I've come up with over the years. For years, I've asked about where the different races came from, what the origin of the races was, and I have no satisfactory answer to date. However, with Sitchin's work in the 12th planet, where he talked about the colonization of the Earth by the Anunnaki, and them rustling, so to speak, one another's workers and taking them around to different places, is it possible that the Anunnaki colored their people in order to brand them, so to speak, in order to keep one another from stealing their workers?
I do not get into any sort of speculation about why you find the emergence in the history of human genetics, why you find the emergence of different races. And the simple reason is from the ancient textual standpoint, which is always kind of my point of departure, you don't really have any indication of those things per se. The closest that you come is the text that my co-author Scott and I examine in The Grid of the Gods. The closest thing that comes to that are some of the statements in Aztec and Mayan literature where there were previous races of humanity. But you have to understand that when those cultures used the term race, they meant something very much like we would use the term species. So it's not necessarily even a racial thing with those cultures. So I really don't even get into that question at all.
All right, let's take a few more calls here, Joseph. The time is clicking by. We'll go to Pekin, Illinois. East of the Rockies, Don's turn. Go ahead, Don. Hello, Don. Well, I don't think he's with us. Well, let us try Gil driving in Arizona. Hey, Gil, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question really quick for your guest. I was wondering if you address the theory that all organic life on Earth is comprised of dead star matter, and how that would tie into what your books are about, or do you even get into it?
Not in this book, no. I don't address that at all. The book was complicated enough without that.
But we are star matter, no doubt.
Yes, there's no doubt about that, yes, but I don't get into that at all in this book. Eventually, probably, I'll get around to addressing some of those issues in a later book.
So I'm going to ask you the $64,000 question, Joseph, and that is, what's it all about? Why are we here? What's the mission? What's the goal?
Well, George, that is the $64,000 question. And, you know, increasingly I come to more or less the same view that you've written about and talked about so many times, and that is basically our purpose here is to love. And I know that sounds kind of perhaps trite and trivial in the context of the discussion tonight, but I really do believe that's the bottom line, that this is a school and that we're put here to learn to love.
You know, you're right. I wish so many people would do that and practice it. There seems to be an evil permeating throughout everything, Joseph.
Yeah, you're right. There is. And we're not going to turn it around, George, I don't think, until we all do exactly like you say, and that's start practicing it.
You got it. UConn in Oklahoma, it's Clint's turn. Hey, Clint.
Yes, I was wanting to talk about, maybe you could touch on the Zahi Hawass.
Sure.
Situation as far as, I think it's, maybe some of the listeners may agree that he's kind of an image, an icon of Egypt. And if he was to be locked away for a year, or anything that would have really fall negative upon Egypt.
Well, let me tell you a little bit, Clint, because we have talked about it. As a matter of fact, Robert Bival talked about it yesterday, and so did Ahmad Osman as we went live to Egypt and the United Kingdom. Zahi Hawass apparently is up on appeal sometime in June. If he's convicted, he goes to jail for a year for a dispute over some land and antiquities. And there's a mixed camp there, as Bhaval was saying, of some people who like Zahi and others who don't. And the camp, it's a bigger camp, those who don't, because they just think he's no question the driving force behind some of Egypt's antiquities, but he does it with a dictatorial hand. And Joseph, it's backfiring on him, I think.
Yeah, it is, George. And I think there's another component to this that needs to be looked at very carefully, and that's the wider context. When the lootings first occurred, Dr. Hawass, and I even put this up as a blog on my website, Dr. Hawass put up a notice on his site that in addition to the looting of art objects in Cairo from the museum, other sites in Egypt had been looted, and that some of the objects taken were stones that had inscriptions on them. So in other words, once again, we're looking at the pattern of the Baghdad Museum looting, because there, again, you had the looting both of art objects and then of cuneiform tablets. And in the covering of the story, in Iraq's case, what we found was it was the art objects that got the coverage and were returned to the museum. But the forgotten part of the story is those tablets are still missing. Some of them turned up in Spain. Spain is refusing to turn them back to Iraq because they're asking Iraq to prove provenance, which, of course, is a very difficult thing because the people keeping the field catalogs of what they were finding in Iraq were the German and French archaeological teams that were doing the digging there. So that's one issue. And you look at the same pattern now emerging in Egypt with the theft of art objects and then their recovery, but no one seems to be talking about those inscribed stones. What were they inscribed with? We don't know. But it looks to me, George, as if someone is looking for information.
I think so.
Yeah.
Joseph, good luck with this book, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men.
Thank you, George.
Do come back in May when your other one's done, okay?
I will, and thank you for having me on, George. It's been a blast, as it always is.
All right, Joseph Farrell, tremendous work, great researcher, and you heard him right here on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.